Yes, I'm doing by hand what you all do by computer. And at some point you might wonder why do it by hand if you can do it by computer. And of course, if I do it by hand, I understand what I do. But it's just nice to have also a view to use. I'm trying to describe all the objects of the universe, galaxies, Lyman alpha clouds, clusters, by an analytical formula. And of course, when I say analytical formula, it's not Press-Schecter because... Got it. Is there a place to focus it? So I said that I'm trying to do by hand what you do by computer, and of course if you do it by hand, sometimes it's a little less accurate, but also sometimes you see things and you understand things you would not at first glance see in a numerical simulation. So it's an effort, well, it's the Patrick Varajas thesis, essentially, to describe clusters by means of analytical formulas that have been, let's say, the survey had been done, let's say, a long time ago, I think the first theoretical step towards having analytical formula and towards understanding what clustering is, Simon White in 79, I think you never imagined that your formula could be used so much and so long and so for so many purposes. And the idea, of course, is to have a hand on the matter density field, have a way, if you find a way to describe the matter density field, well, you are able to extract from this field objects like galaxies, clouds, and so on, and recognize them and try to see what they become in the past, how they evolve. And of course, to do this, well, you have to have two things. One is to have a good description of the density field that you can handle by hand. And the second thing, of course, is to attach physical properties of the objects. Luminosity for galaxies, X-ray luminosity for clusters, temperatures, and so on. Density for Lyman alpha clouds. To describe the density field, we all know how the density field looks like. It's just a matter of having the right tools to do this. And all these people have contributed to find out what the right tools were. The density field, well, it's fluctuations according to, so let's say, around some mean density. And you all know that these fluctuations, if you go to smaller scales, I'm trying to take them in cup. If you go to smaller scales, it works. If you go to smaller scales, you get more fluctuations of smaller, let's say, of smaller scale, but of higher amplitude. If you go to even smaller scales, you get even higher fluctuations, let's say, with higher amplitude. And there are ways to describe this, which are not just used in a computer simulation. These ways, the aim of what I want to do is, of course, to extract from these fluctuations various things that are very, very, very different in nature. For instance, galaxies, it's 10 to the 12 or 10 to the 11 solar masses in 10 or 100 kiloparsec. It's density contrast of, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 4. Lyman alpha clouds, on the other hand, are much smaller objects, but also the density contrast is astonishingly low. 10 to the 4 is high, but some of the Lyman alpha clouds have a density contrast which is below unity, much, much below unity. And what happens is these are clouds of very, very low densities, but of course they are in a medium which is of even lower density. That's why they stick out on an absorption line. So to describe this,
we don't really know that, but No, I know. I know it's written here, you know. Well, no, let's say, what you know is the current density. That doesn't come from a simulation. And now we have to guess what the size of the cloud is. You can understand that the size of the cloud, you can have a hand on what it is independently of the simulations. And then it's just a matter of dividing one by the other to get the density contrast. And so I will give arguments why the radius is worth even. You have measures. Even looking at neighboring line of sights, you have some hint of what this radius is, and you know it's a few hundred kiloparsecs, and everybody has been saying long before one was able to do the simulations that 100 kiloparsecs is a typical size of a cloud, and it's a typical galaxy size actually, but it's not a galaxy. So of course, and you can also with the same means describe clusters or groups, but all those who do press Schechter calculation, clusters have a density of 100, and all people who do press Schechter calculation know that this is easy to do using the press Schechter formulation. So, and of course, they also know that this describes these objects with this density contrast. This is not possible to be done by, let's say, the press Schechter approximation. So, and of course, you have the questions that one has to add to this is what the physical properties of these objects. What defines a Lyman alpha cloud? What defines a cluster? What defines a group? Why is it why a given object is it a cluster? Why is it a group? Why is it not a galaxy? And so on. So I will come into this, let's say, when necessary. First, I will try to tell you what the density field is, and this will take me some time because, it's the answer is simple, but the why the answer looks like this, it's a little more difficult to understand. So the best way to describe the density field is to take it, divide the universe into cells of a given size, and to look at the mass distribution. Of course, the average mass in a cell is the average density of the universe times the volume of the cell. So this is nothing very special. The average square mass is related to the correlation function. It's actually the fluctuation in the cell, but you know that the fluctuations in the cell is related by a very simple means to the two-body correlation function. It's just a kind of average of the two-body correlation function within the cell. And so, and of course, this is Xi bar, which describes, let's say, is a similar power law. If the two-body correlation function is a power law, this Xi bar is a power law. And this R0 is nothing else than the 8 h-1 megaparsec that I've been using, 65 kilometers per second per megaparsec. It's on now 13. So if you see 8, you recognize it. If you see 13, you don't recognize it, but it's the same thing. So this is the usual 8. When people say the fluctuations are unity at 8 h-1 megaparsec, it's really Z Xi bar they put to unity. Sorry? It's what they observe for the galaxies, and of course, if I use the matter density field, if I would describe galaxy counts in the cells, I would use 8, and it's true. There's a bias, and I will not speak about bias. You have done a lot of work on bias, so I think I know the bias is about 2. The same means, I will never tell it about the same means that I will use to describe the density field, allows me also to describe the bias, and I can calculate the bias of galaxies. And just I chose not to speak about this, and of course I should say that it's 13 for galaxies and at a factor of 2 in 2 square in front.
No, you're making the assumption this is a power law.
I am making the assumption it's a power law. We made checks for CDM simulations, and the rules we find were also true in CDM simulations. And you know the correlation function looks reasonably like a power law, but it's not a power law. So it's not very sensitive to some deviations to a power law. but it's true that I'm having in mind that all what I will say is having in mind that correlation functions are power laws or close to power laws.
So the aim to use this now is so I can count the mass distribution within the cells. I can count the number of cells containing a mass m, and find the multiplicity function of the cells within mass m. And what I will explain you, but I give you the result before having an explanation, is that this mass distribution within the cell, mu of m dm, can be written. Of course, it depends on what? It depends on psi bar, it depends on the mass, it depends on the radius of the cell, it depends on the average density of the universe. This mass distribution within the cells can be written in terms of one unique variable. This mu of m should be really m given a rho bar, given a psi bar, and so on. This can be written as a unique function of a unique parameter x that takes together everything, the mass, the density, the radius, and the psi bar. We'll shortly explain you why this is true, and this has something to do with the correlation functions behaving as power laws. So this ratio x can also be written as the density contrast 1 plus delta divided by psi bar. It's the same thing. So this is also the distribution of the density contrast. Just to... Yes, and of course, I will come to this very shortly later, but of course, the reason why this is true is that all the correlation functions behave as power laws. Not only the two-body correlation, but all the correlation functions behave. It's a kind of fractal property, just avoid to use it. But I avoid to use fractal because Pietro Nero has another fractal that is nonsense. And so if I say fractal, people think it's just junk and don't listen anymore. But of course, if you know things about fractals, you will recognize many of the properties that I tell you that are just fractal properties. But it's not Pietro Nero's fractal by no means. Just to give you some hint why there is such a distribution H of X. Probably some of you have read people's book, 1980 book, not the recent one, the old one. Pibbs tells you at some point what's the origin of the power law of the correlation function. He has a kind of spherical collapse argument. He follows a density contrast. You have a patch of matter that expands. It's a little over dense, so it expands slower. It starts to collapse. And just from the matter contained into the cell, that cell that collapses, from its radius after collapse, you have the mass contained in the cell, and the Peebles tells you that the two-body correlation function, which is nothing else than in some way the number of neighbors, is related to the mass, the radius of that cell, and the redshift at which it collapses by this relation here. What you really see that this thing here, m over rho bar r cube psi bar, that in Peebles model is unity, these two things are just equal in Peebles model. That's the way he calculates the correlation function and shows you it's a power law related to initial conditions. Just what you find really out, that what Peebles says is really true, but except for one thing, is that for a given radius of the collapsed object, for a given redshift, for a given correlation function, there is a distribution in masses, but this distribution in masses is just given by Peebles' estimate, which is that thing for the mass of the object given a correlation function, or for the correlation function given a mass. And there is a distribution that is just labeled by a dimensionless quantity x. So x is just a probability distribution of something that people, let's say, just assumed this was a unique mass. So this, it's interesting. well, I can show you what H is. So, of course, I have in mind to describe the very nonlinear regime with very, very strong fluctuations. So, I have in mind that this psi bar is much, much larger than unity. So, you know, we know this picture psi bar is at least 200 or so. So I have a picture. So when psi bar is very, very large, this H is not a Gaussian. It's clear that with the same mathematical tools that I'm using, that I don't show you here, if I would use my formula, not in the regime of psi bar is much, much larger than unity, but much, much smaller than unity, I would get a Gaussian for H. So you have really an interpolation between the linear regime and the nonlinear regime. It's just that I'm focusing, I want to describe what happens today with the actual density field, and all these objects have sizes that are smaller than h minus 1 megaparsec, so they're all in the nonlinear regime. So I chose to stick. And so in the nonlinear regime, this h of x is a power law with an exponential cutoff. And I will shortly tell you why it's a power law later on, but just getting the result is just nice. It's fun to see that this looks like a Schechter function, not press Schechter. It's a Schechter function, you know, the power law of the galaxy distribution with the exponential cutoff is really built in this function, this scaling function H. And of course, there's a distribution for all values of X. There's a small X cutoff that I don't show here because it's a little complicated, that cutoff. But just if you look, this is a power law, and we were able to estimate from first principles bounds for this value of omega for this power law. And of course, you see that omega between 0 and 1 looks like the alpha of the Schechter function. It's really in the range of what values of power of luminosity you use for just a simple distribution function. And it's also E minus L over L star would be a Schechter function.
There's no reason why this should be related.
But it will come. It will come, and so it will come. I can tell you just something in the beginning. This X is the mass in some units. If I say that all galaxies have one red, the mass in a cell. So I will do things much more complicated in the following. But just here at the first, if I say all galaxies have the same radius, X is nothing else than the mass divided by some constant. And if I say that the mass is, the luminosity is proportional to the mass, I get an E minus L over L star here, and I get an L to the power of omega minus 2 here. Of course, the nature is more complicated than this, and I will show you a true luminosity function with fancy estimates of what the radius should be and what the luminosity should be, but just a very naive, simple argument of having everyone be the same shows you that it's really the Schechter function you see here in a simplified, let's say, in a simplified approach. And just because you would, well, and just a remark, because I'll have drawings later on this, if I put x square h of x, it's a function with a maximum somewhere at x star. I will need this later on. These scalings have been checked by people. François Boucher was the first one. In numerical simulations, and for instance, this is a check using CDM initial conditions, and it works reasonably well in a range where the correlation function is not so, it was not 200, it was 10, 20 or so, you know. It works in a range which with a correlation function that wiggles around the power law. Nevertheless, the scaling holds. So, and of course, it has been checked subsequently for a power law initial condition, and then it works really beautifully. I have the plots here. It has also been checked looking to the, against data, looking at the galaxy distributions in the CFA and the SSRS.
and with a scatter which is considerably larger than in the simulations, because galaxies, well, you have less galaxies in the samples and points in the simulations. It looks like that this scaling holds also for the galaxy distribution. I don't show it. If people are interested, I have the transparencies, but I think it would take me too much time. So, of course, this is some qualitative approach. There is a theory behind it, and that's, of course, the way we stepped in, is trying to do the true theory of that scaling function h of x. And, well, the assumptions and the things, the hypothesis behind are that you have many body correlation functions, the probability of having a point at R1, another one at R2, and another one at Rn. And this scaling, these correlation functions obey scaling laws that are exact when you have power law initial conditions, and some people think they might be reached approximately at late times, even if you don't have power law initial conditions. It's exact with power law initial conditions.
If you can show that there is a scaling solution that works.
Yes.
Solution of the BBDK Y hierarchy.
Yes.
You have solutions. You don't. You have no proof that starting from
I have no proof that starting from any initial condition it will converge to one of the scaling. But if I have initial power law conditions, I am at the scaling solution, and the computer. It's a power law, yes, but it's a power law above 200, say. We looked into this. Since we talk about this, I can show you a little earlier than expected some results. This is the check using power law initial conditions of that scaling. And this is the H of X, and these are the computer simulation, and this is what Cedric Lasset. And you see there are deviations around something that really looks like the scaling, and these deviations are deviations from, you take power law initial conditions, and at the end it's not really from the power law initial conditions. You should have an exact self-similarity, and at late times it's not that the computer simulation doesn't really show this. It shows this scaling variance, but not exactly. And this is due to the fact that you have a smoothing at small scales, you have many things. Let's say, if you take power law initial conditions, you have a scaling relation, which is not my scaling relation, between scale and time. Things depend on your ratio of scale and time. And this is independent of my... I'm saying something different, that the various parameters combine together to build one unique... Yeah, and well, the violations are here, let's say. There is really a scatter, and it was a surprise to me also. I thought that you have the exact solution, you start with exact initial conditions, which are self-similar. I don't know where it comes from, because we discovered it after the paper had been written, actually, there were violations. Yes. They produce it in some range. Yes. Yes. Okay. I agree with you that let's say. Well, I can even above 200 they are really parallels, and when I make checks in simulations at places where the correlation function is 10 or 20, it nevertheless works, and it shouldn't, let me put it this way. But I realized 10 years after we had done the paper on CDM that we had checked these things at places where the correlation function was about 10, and it reasonably worked, but you expect it to work above 200. So you take this assumption. It's true when the correlation function is larger than something that we could agree to set at 200. And having all these correlation functions be power law, you can define the probability that your work of having, no point in a given cell or having n point in a given cell. What we really did is to use this approach for a continuous density field when n goes to infinity, and of course if you have a few points in the cell divide, taking derivatives is possible. If you have an infinite number, you have to use other techniques. So this is a complicated mathematical way to go through this, but with the same principle, just replacing the derivative for something that is tractable when the number of derivations goes to infinity, you can define, let's say, the probability distribution in a given cell, and show that indeed it's given by that scaling function h of x, and the scaling really just depends only on that property of the correlation functions. And from general rules, just having probabilities to be positive and so on, and we have positivity rules also of Legendre transformation, we were able to show that the power law, there should be a power law at small scales, or if there is a power law at small scales, it can only be omega minus 2 with omega between 0 and 1, and shows that you should normally, the expected thing is to have an exponential decay at large scales, unless there is some accident, let's say. This is the theory, so you cannot really calculate h of x, but you can show that it has very precise properties, and you can make models to see whether in an approximate way you can. So you know that this h of x exists, you know that you have a scaling, and then you can just construct h of x or measure it in a numerical simulation, and once you have it, you take it and you can do whatever you want with it. You have models for this h of x, and this is the press sector approximation. And of course, written, everyone here has at least once in his life, and probably much more than once in his life, written down the press sector formula. You know that there is a mu, which is the number of, let's say, the comparison of the density contrast with the fluctuations. You have a new parameter nu, it goes like e to the minus nu square, and times some factors depending on nu in front of the exponential. You can transform this formula in which this nu is delta square of the linear correlation function. You all know that there is a Hamilton and collaborators proposed to relate the nonlinear correlation function to the linear correlation function by a very keen formula, which is a little involved, but if you think it twice, it's really a keen formula. It's really a formulation that allows you to calculate the nonlinear correlation function as a function of the linear correlation function. If I use this Hamilton relation, I can transform, express the linear correlation function in terms of the nonlinear correlation function. And what comes out is that the press Schechter formula that I had in the beginning, e to the minus mu square, just gives me an estimate for this function h of x. And of course, you have a power law here. The n's you like go from 0, let's say, to minus 3, and you see that from between 0 and minus 3, if they go from 1 to minus 3, let's say the n's you like, from between 1 and minus 3, this is the parameter omega. It's indeed between 0 and 1. And you have also the exponential. It's not linear in x, but it depends on some power of x. So, but what is amazing is that the press Schechter formula that just rewritten in terms of other quantities than the linear correlation function that you're used to, written in terms of the nonlinear correlation function, is such a scaling function h of x. But of course, if you look at the power you get here compared to the power you get with the same initial conditions, with a given n in a numerical simulation, you see that the omega here also satisfies the bound of being between 0 and 1. It's not the right value you get from the simulation. And also the simulation tells you it's really exponential with a linear function of x here. And the Prescher predicts you it's something different here. It's a power of x except for say n equals minus 2, I think, which is an exception. Also Prescher gives you a simple estimate of this scaling function. It's not good enough to describe the nonlinear density. It's just good enough to tell you that indeed all what you say, Sering collapse, Prescher and so on, all this is somewhat related and qualitatively. Yes, it's nearly the same. I will argue that it's very, very close. Of course, I am using Prescher here in the regime where you have said many times that Prescher gives me a scaling function. I'm happy about this because it's just an example that this function, scaling function, exists, that you can construct at least one, even if it's not perfect. It's very clear that I already told you Prescher doesn't work, and it doesn't work because I'm using it at delta above 200, where you know it doesn't work, but never. So would you try to do what I do with Prescher? It would not work because of this. And so I showed you that, let's say, I lost my transparency. And of course, I can show you here that this is the Prescher prediction. And so, of course, this x ranges over a large number of values, and somewhere in this value of x, 200 is included.
But it's not a prediction for the count themselves, which is what it's
Prescher, if you start with the Prescher formula, the first thing you do, you write down the fluctuations and the probability of finding a given density contrast in a given radius. If you think a little about it, it's counting cells. You take the linear formula, you take the linear regime.
Yeah.
Yes, let's say for the moment I am just confusing the two things, and it's willingly I will try to explain you. In many cases it's the same thing, so that with little differences. But if you look at the Prescher, what you do when you write down the Prescher formula, you go to the linear regime, you choose a given size, you can call it radius or you can call it mass, it doesn't matter. In the linear regime it's the same thing because the density contrast is small compared to 1. What you really do is to look at the distribution of matter in cells
in the initial
conditions. In the initial conditions, and what you do, but it's really a distribution of cells. In the initial conditions, but once you have done this, you keep it. You say, well, these initial conditions will give me objects later on. Yes, but what you do with the Prescher in the linear regime is going from counts in cells to objects without saying it. You see, what you really do is to make a statistics in the linear regime of cells, and you decide that these are going to be the objects.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the derivation.
Yeah, but what I say, you can phrase it much more precisely. Prescher gives you the number of cells of size R that are, let's say, above a given quantity, then trust
R.
In the initial conditions, yes.
It would be another way. Most people are expressed in Prescher, not by the way it was derived, good by the fact that he's supposed to appear there and secondarily as being reasonable in simulation and given the number of collapsed objects of a given mass of a given weight, not because they're wise.
Sure, yes.
Way, I mean, that's not the success of Quark Sector, right? The
yes.
success is that to identify collapsed objects that work reasonably well independently of shady
parts
of the derivation.
Yeah, okay. But, so, if you have said derivation, what you do is the statistics in sense in the linear regime, but if you use proto objects in the linear regime, that later on they decide they would be real objects. It's true that, but now, if I have these proto objects, I can do exactly the reverse, having the number of objects and derive the fluctuations in cells. It's just, it's the same formula. There's a relation between the fluctuations in cells and the objects in the linear regime. So, let's say, yeah, okay. But nevertheless, in deepening of the derivation, if I use this form, okay, I will keep this, I will show it later on. So just two words before going really to describing objects. This density field, so I told you it's given by some function h of x, which is a power load and an exponential cutoff. If I translate this into density contrast and scales, let's say, I see that P of delta is a power law, and it drops out when delta becomes of the order of this psi bar of R. And this, now, if I sample the universe in the nonlinear regime with smaller and smaller cells, I get a distribution which is broader and broader, which arbitrarily large. You see, delta becomes arbitrarily large because the smaller I get, the smaller cells I take, the larger psi bar I have. And so I see that I get cells with arbitrary large density contrast. But also I get, let's say, if I integrate over delta P, integral delta P of delta d delta, I see that most of the mass is within just in this region here. And so I get arbitrarily large densities with all the mass in this large density clumps. If I sample it with very, very small scales, I have really extremely large densities and the small cells and all the masses within the small cells. And of course, if I calculate the volume occupied by these small cells, it's a negligible amount. So these overdense cells have very large density contrast and negligible volume despite they occupy a negligible volume, it's, they contain nearly all the mass. And of course, these properties look like fractal properties.
So that's one that doesn't do the whole simulation?
It does.
If you go smaller and smaller cells, then you find a smaller and smaller fraction of the mass in
We looked this in Cedric Lasse's simulation. Yeah, and of course at the limit of resolution, and when the power was dropping, it was always at the limit of resolution. Yeah. Let's say, if you're right, this scaling h of x should be violated at some small scales, which are very small, and it's something, one of the things I would be happy to find out with you is how small is that scale.
Well, you know, for example, if you look at very high resolution simulations of people with individual halos, you find you show a lot of substructure.
Yes, and of course, and are you sure this is not because you don't have the resolution at small scales?
You
Let's say, if you write the scaling law, H of X should be violated at going too small, to small enough scales. I must say that for the moment, I worked.
In any case, I mean, these scaling laws were inspired by the observed by European colleagues. Here we're talking about scales with a sort of halo scale.
But I'm happy to talk about halo scales because in my mind this is goes down to let's say 10. I'm happy to go to small scales. 1 kiloparsec is the scale, 10 kiloparsec is the scale that I'm interested in. So and of course there is a question to which small scales can you go. All I can say is that for the moment, at the simulations I've been looking at, each time one had deviations at small scales, it was not clear whether the simulation was right or not right. And there is a discussion in the paper of Lasse about this, and it's clear it's an important issue. In my mind, I'm not so convinced that, we should talk, I think. So, and what you can also show that in this, you know, you have the small x cutoff in this part here. Most of the surroundings are less dense than the cells you look at. And in this part here, most of the surroundings of these underdone cells are more dense than the cells you look at. But if you look at the density contrast delta, it goes from psi bar, think 200 or more, to something which is 1 over psi bar, think 10 to the minus 2 or less. So you have cells here, and the prediction is to have cells which are surrounded by less dense regions, despite the density contrast, this is really 1 plus delta, sorry. This is 1 plus delta here. Despite 1 plus delta goes to something which is very, very close to 0. So for 1 plus delta, between 10 to the minus 2 to more than 100, you have objects, or let's say you have dense cells surrounded by less dense cells, and of course you start to recognize objects, and you start to see that the distribution in cells has something to do with objects. Because I calculated it. Because, you know, you can calculate, you have ways with this Pavlov correlation function, you can calculate the bias, you can calculate the probability of having a given mass, knowing that you have a mass in a given cell, what you have in a corona around the cell. And I know that on the average here, these cells are surrounded by less dense material. And I know that on the average, these cells here, when the drop-off occurs, are surrounded by more dense material. And so,
what you're saying is that for a given density contrast, which were dominated by, is always by peaks of that density contrast.
Yes, yes.
And not by
part. Yes. And that's very specific of the nonlinear regime. In the linear regime, it would not be the case. And having a peak, usually you have nothing around. Yes. 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 And if I give when I come to this, what you really can show, but don't look at. Anyway. Now, I had this distribution for this distribution of mass in given cells. There's just a very simple way to go from this distribution. Of course, when you have a cell with matter inside, you don't know what is around. And what you want really is now to recognize having a cell with some matter, having the cell where the matter is isolated to get objects. And what you do is you calculate the probability of having a density larger than something in a cell at the given radius r, and you subtract the probability of having a density larger than the same thing at the radius r plus dr. If you do this in the linear regime, you get the Press-Schecter formula. If you do this in the nonlinear regime, you show that the mass function and not the distribution in the cell is given exactly by the same formula, h of x dx. And so that the cells, the cell distribution, the Kantian cell distribution and the objects have just the same formula.
Yes. In order to get across the megaparsec across, because to find the mass of the object, you have to count things which are thousands of across, not one cell.
Yeah, but okay. So I just let's divide the universe slightly differently. I choose a density contrast, 10^6 or 10^8 or so on.
No, but the normal number of galaxy clusters is 10^2, not 10^6. Galaxy cluster. Even the center may be where it's 10^10.
Yeah. Okay.
The 100.
Yeah. So if you take all the objects with a density contrast larger than 200, for instance, you get what you say, the big objects with spikes in them and substructure in them.
What I'm saying is that the same 10^6 in finding objects.
Yes. And
well, from my argument, you're going to identify this as the galaxy cluster, as the object.
No, I told you at the beginning I need a rule to say what is a cluster and what is a galaxy. And I will find out the rule for you in a few minutes. And of course, the rule will tell me that very simple galaxies are objects with a density contrast of 10^6. I can divide using this scaling formula. I can divide the universe into objects of 10^6. Take a constant density contrast just to simplify things. If I divide the universe in objects with density contrast of 10^6, I get isolated galaxies. I get the galaxies in clusters, and I get the galaxy mass function. If I divide the universe in objects with density contrast 200, I get the clusters. And of course, the two things, and if I choose 10^6, I can choose that all the mass is with an object of 10^6. But if I choose 200, I can also choose that all the mass is in object with a density of 200. It's just it's a different division. It's a different partition of the objects. Okay.
We'll have some cells which have, say,
10^8.
Above 10^6.
Yeah. Very far above
the threshold. Now, the mass above 10^6,
which is associated with the 10^8 cell. Yes. Not just the mass in the 10^8 cell, but also surrounding the cells of the 10^7, the ones around. Yes, okay, yes. You have to get all those cells. We get 10. Yes. Maybe I can make a drawing of this, which might make things simpler. Let's say, if I divide the universe into cells of density contrast of 200, I get the mass is divided among objects like this. If I now choose 10^6, I get objects that look like this. Let's say, well, okay. And would I choose 10^8, I would get objects which look like this.
No, but some of your 10^6 objects will actually be 10^8. In other words, that cell.
Of course, but if I choose to select all the 10^8 objects, I will have divided the mass of the universe.
Yeah. Object, is that a single cell or all contiguous cells above the threshold?
It's a cell with an underdense surrounding.
Well. No, you keep going, you turn it that cell, but yeah. You say object, is that one cell?
You can choose to divide the universe into cells of a given radius and look at the densities. If I do this, I have to count all the cells that are, let's say, above a given threshold. And of course, as you say, I don't know what the neighbors are. If I subtract all the cells that are, at a slightly larger scale, are also above the same threshold, what remains are the cells which are isolated. And I'm saying that the distribution of the mass in these cells, if I integrate the mass of all these cells, I get all the mass in the universe. If, say, this density was 10^6. I do the same.
So what you're saying, these 10^6 contributions not be the one cell, or the group cell?
I can do what I want.
It's,
yeah. No, but it depends on the object I consider. Let's say. Yes. Well, let's say. Okay. So, X is M over something like rho bar, R cube, psi of R. I have eta of M, dm over M, which is my mass function, equals X h of x dx, and depends.
That's the mass itself.
Yes. Now you see that if you give me m, I'm not able to tell you what x is unless someone tells me how r is related to m. I need to get the mass function. I need any additional information. Is to say how R is related to M. If you tell me how R is related to M, I can construct from this rule a mass function for you. The relation R, this relation R to the M, defines what the object is.
I
for instance, R going. Yeah, so I use the Kármán set to construct this relation. But now, if I have cells which are not a given density, but cells, for instance, which have a given density contrast, I can. Yeah. Let's see. I have a luminosity function, a multiplicity function. I say it's given. Yes. Okay, yes. I started to look at cells at fixed R. I derived this rule. At half mdm equal h of x dx, with r is constant. Step one. Step two, what I'm saying, that at half mdm over m is equal to h of x dx, with x given by this formula, even if r depends on m. I used r constant because it was simpler to derive this relation. But even if R depends on M, this relation still remains true.
Well, so then I don't understand how you interpret this relation. If R is, you're not talking about a fixed ring of cells, it's some basis, then how do you interpret
this relation? Let's say, for instance, if M equals to delta R cube, this is a function R of M, I get, this gives me the distribution of all cells with a given density contrast 1 plus delta. Yes, I started to have a fixed R to derive the relation, and now I claim, step 2, that this relation is still true if R depends on M. And this second. Yeah, and simply this is Valajar's thesis, let's say, to show that for R, for a function R of M, you have the same relation. And even he looked at deviations of this relation, and it's a long story.
Now we're saying over here, these things are really our contours of density contrast of 10 to 6, and they have different sizes.
Yeah, I'm saying that if someone gives me the relation R of M, I can construct a multiplicity function at R of M dm. From this relation. And for instance, if someone asks me to select all objects with a given radius r, I use the previous formula. If someone asks me to select all the objects with a given density contrast delta, I use this r of n with this function to get another mass function r of n. If someone gives me a very complicated function r of m, which could be, any function r of m, I can construct a mass function. Each time someone gives me a function r of m, I can divide the mass in the universe into objects with that satisfy this rule. So it could be constant radius, constant density contrast, or something much more complicated. Yes.
And then that makes the hypothesis that pressure is exactly equivalent to the convention.
Let's say my hypothesis for delta equals 200 is very, very similar to Press Schecter, with one minor difference is that the shape of h of x is not exactly Press Schecter. Let me put it this way. It's just Press Schecter with something I claim is better than Press Schecter for h of x. And since I still have, this is, the, you know, my h of x is the full curve, Press Schecter would be the dotted curve. The way you are using Press Schecter is here. Are the two things I mean. And this is roughly where the density contrast of 200 for the big clusters, these values of x correspond to big clusters of, say, a few megaparsec radius and density contrast of 200. Yeah, just to show that Press Schecter wasn't good.
No, it's much closer, yeah.
Yeah, well, x, well, you are checking it here, and I don't have the plus.
Yeah,
x goes like mass, and yes, you checked it of 5 orders of magnitude, but not at a given time, at various times, I assume. But it didn't, it doesn't work over 5 orders of magnitude.
It's not great,
you should show me, because there is a very specific prediction that the slope here is not the same for the small masses as Schecter. And if you have a plot somewhere, I would be happy to see it. Because I did that in Cedric's simulation. The deficiency of the small masses, yes. My prediction would be that my prediction would be that the slope is definitely not the same, and I would be interested to see your. I should go to galaxies at some time, and not this was just a preparation. Maybe I'll start. Well, I'll try to go a little faster because you know all know galaxies. So, we are using this aim to move the game now. Let's take an object, a given object, galaxies. There is some physics in galaxies. Something told you that you make a galaxy is not a cluster or not a group of galaxies. So, from this mass function and plus the rule R of m. This rule R of M tells me what the object is. And for instance, if I decide that the galaxy is an object that can cool within Hubble time, while any larger objects and the one I'm considering will not cool within Hubble time at formation, this is a statement of what R of M is. I'm using dark matter masses everywhere, and there is a fixed ratio variant to dark matter. So it doesn't matter. Well, okay, and when I talk about galaxies, always the galaxy with its halo. So, and let's say if you take the... Yeah, and you know, this is just that the onset of collapse and the baryons are still spread over the whole halo, and that's the place I set the condition. So you have a fixed ratio between baryons and dark matter at that time. So I'm saying this is the place where this is an object with a fairly uniform density, which is going to collapse, but in a collapse time it's able to cool, while a larger object in a collapse time is not able to cool. And you can write down this condition mathematically, and it just gives you a relation between the mass, the density, and of course the cooling function, and which gives you an R of M. So, this is the definition of galaxies, and the group, of course, would be an object that is not able to cool within a Hubble time, but inside it has objects which cool within a Hubble time, and it has substructure which make the galaxies. So, this is the definition of galaxies. Now,
modeling the galaxies, you have to have a star formation rate, you have to have supernova ejection to remove some of the matter to prevent stars to form and so on. What you have done for the star formation, the supernova and everything, is exactly what you all do. So maybe I just skip this. The only remark I want to make is there are a lot of parameters, of course, to model a galaxy, and you have fixed all the parameters on our own galaxy. And so it's a model which is predictive if you go, for instance, at a high redshift or so on. There's no pre-parameter. Everything is fixed on our own galaxy. Except one thing is the supernova rate has been fixed by adjusting the relation between luminosity and metallicity for the small galaxies. So this is the only thing that has not been fixed on our own galaxy. But everything has been fixed on properties that, let's say, are measured and known by today. And so we have no free parameters once we have done this. So, with this rule, this is the cooling curve, and this is delta equals 200. So a galaxy is, this is the curve, it's a relation between density and temperature. And on this curve, objects are able to cool within a Hubble Timet formation. Of course, you want this object to be virialized also. So the relation between density and temperature, which defines galaxies, is the green curve. Let's say on this curve, objects should be virialized and able to cool within a Hubble Timet formation. This curve of rho as a function of t is nothing else than a relation r as a function of m that defines what the luminosity, the mass function of the galaxy will be. And so, having attached a luminosity with my star formation, right, and so on. Yes, but rho of t, I say rho of t is a unique function, and of course, yes. Depending on which variable you take, you have a unique solution or you don't have a unique solution. And we found that the temperature is a much better characteristic of a galaxy than the radius, for instance. And so instead of saying the relation R of M, I could have said I need the relation M of T or T of M. And this would be, have been a correct statement, and R of M is not the correct statement. Simply I started with R and showing a Compton cell and so on. It was simpler to show you R of M, but you're right. So with this recipe and with the function h of x used for cold dark matter, let's say with the standard cold dark matter model omega equals 0.3 is equal to 0, this is the function we get. And I must say that this curve depends on many parameters that are all adjusted on properties of our own galaxy. And so the prediction of having something that gives the galaxy luminosity function is it's a prediction. What turns out is that you see that people are complaining this is the exponential fall off, this is the power law here, but the power law was desperately flat here. And to model this flatness of the power law was always difficult. If you look here, this flatness of the power law just comes from the fact that you have a change of regime. You see, it's a complicated curve here. You have a flat part, a steep part, and a nearly flat part here. This thing here translates into a special feature just at L, somewhat below L star, and gives you that flat part here. So the conjunction of virialization and cooling gives you that flat part here. And of course, at the faint end, you enter this is the limit of virialization. You get something which is the usual power law, which is somewhat steeper. And the people have always been complaining that the luminosity function wasn't steep enough to observe one. And the answer is, it's not steep enough here, but probably for small objects, it will get steeper.
And there is some hint that the luminosity function gets steeper. So this is one thing that we can explain just from this cooling and from knowing what the mass function is. There is something else we can explain. Yes? No. Yeah. No. Let's say maybe it wasn't. No. You have just virialized objects, which is a flat curve, and over-virialized objects, which is this cooling curve. They have a density constant much above 200. They're all virialized, of course. But you have just virialized objects here, which gives you a steep power law, and this cooling, these objects, which are determined by the cooling with an Hubble time deformation, which gives you, at least in this part here, a flat slope. And I claim that. No, it's a virialized deformation. Which part you're talking about? The flat line is virialized by 2. You have to have this object cool, but also you want them to be virialized by today. Or either in the past or today, but not in the future. So these objects will virialize in the future. So you have a cut here and a cut here. So these are virialized long in the past, and these are virialized today. So if you go backwards in redshift now, this is something that say I can draw the same curve at various redshifts, and say z equals 0, and I have a student that keeps predicting the future. But, well, so take z equals 0 here. This is the curve I showed you just before, and now it takes z equals 2. At z, if I apply the same recipe at z equals 2, I have objects that just virialize and objects which are determined by cooling. So if you think a little bit, take z equals 0 here. This is the curve today. Take z slightly positive, you will have a flat curve here and the same curve here. So you see that if you go in the past, these objects here, their definition changes. Here, and if you look really how it changes, these are continuously merging objects here. When this flat line goes up, when the flat line goes down as a function of time, it defines continuously merging objects. While here, this line remains fixed. Let's say if I take z equals, say, 0.5 is here. If I take z equals 0.5, these objects have been merging and changing. This curve didn't change. These objects are exactly the same than they were at z equals 0. So you have a collection of objects which are really quiet objects with really no merging, and objects here which is very, very strong merging. And of course, the more you go upwards in redshift, the more you have continuously merging objects. And if you take, for instance, our galaxy here, it's about here, our galaxy, you see that our galaxy was part of the continuously merging objects up to z equals 2, and after z equals 2, our galaxy was a rather quiet object. Yeah. Yeah, and I claim this is why the disk forms. Is this? These are galaxies. Clusters is something different. Cluster is defined by delta equals 200 here. If I would draw this curve to clusters, it would all be delta equals 200 here. If I look at clusters and go backwards in redshift, they all have a continuous merging history. Just like the small galaxies here. You see, the clusters is delta equals 200. If I go backwards in redshift, they all merged. This is something very special for the objects which are determined by their cooling. And so I'm just claiming our galaxy was quiet since z equal 2. And having been quiet since z equal 2, this is why we have a disk in our galaxy. And we have attached metallicity to the star formation. The relation between luminosity and metallicity has been adjusted
on the known distribution today, and let's say of objects. So we have a prediction for metallicity. It happened. But this prediction for metallicity, the metallicity we get for our galaxy at this place here, is exactly the metallicity where the let's say you have no stars in the disk and the stars are in the halo. So we have even a prediction for this metallicity which agrees with, let's say, what people know, that the low metal stars were formed in the halo and to the, let's say, above, say, minus 0.7 in metallicity, the stars were formed in the disk. And so this sets a date in measured, if I measure the time as a function of, in terms of metallicity, this sets a time where the disk has formed, and we get the right metallicity at that point here, without doing anything special to get it. It's just because we fit the luminosity and metallicity relation today. So I think this is a prediction that for the, let's say, this comforts us with the idea that having this picture is a way to explain how the disk forms and why, let's say, why you have isolated objects, quiet objects that form disks at the large mass side, and continuously merging objects at the low mass side. So, let's say also we get the Tully-Fisher relation without any effort, just because, well, so there are many things, but I think the really new thing is the relation between the disk formation and the metallicity, and the fact that you have objects which are continuously merging, the fact you have objects which are quiet. This is one new thing, and the second new thing is that the flat luminosity, the luminosity function which is flat at L somewhat below L star has something to do with cooling. So, well, I think I'll skip. Well, we want predictions as a function of redshift. Well, of course, we are making predictions as a function of redshift with this, of course. And well, the only thing you have difficulty in fitting is the star formation rate that you know increases dramatically at z equals 1 or at in the very recent past. And we are not, this is the only thing we are not able to reproduce. And I don't want to make too much an effort to do it because it's really beyond what we have done. And if it's true, it must be something very new and very different, and, which doesn't fit in our ideas. But you know, we have a reasonable prediction on the count as a function of redshift. Well,
why the redshift increased the self-efficient rate with that time in E41? It really can hardly be true. If the observations are true, then the model.
Yes, of course. But
why is the crucial?
Well, you know, it's a kind of theoretical view of how things should look like, and if you put numbers on this, many, many things work, except one. So you can worry. So I'm just worried because all the things are reasonably good. Well, you just see the counts.
I understand that in New York,
I didn't say that. I'm just saying that it's the only thing. You see, you make a model of galaxies today. Everything you say, if it's true, it should be true at z equals 1 or z equals 0.5 or 1.5. And if you make that model, nothing special happens at z equals 1 or z equals 0.5. So why should you get such a strong burst? Unless you make something very unusual for the you can always adjust the star formation rate and put a new time scale in the star formation rate. But I'm saying that either these observations are going to go away, or there is new physics or new information with a preferred time scale that is equals 1 that comes in with some special.
There is a time scale in cosmology. If the universe is lambda CDM, then there is.
We have done calculations for omega equals 1 and.
If
this should change. I agree with you, but
the first thing this will change is the shape of the, I didn't show the evolution of the luminosity function as a function of redshift. Of course, if you put lambda CDM,
well, I'm just saying the evolution, something may happen,
but the shape of the luminosity function definitely will change if you use lambda CDM. That the star formation changes is harder to believe, because star formation right, is intrinsic to the galaxy.
Maybe it's to do with collisions.
Yes. Yeah, of course, you're right, but okay.
It's not out of the question, but something very bizarre.
No, I'm just worried.
Science usually goes the other way.
No, I'm just worried.
Observation is enough.
I'm just worried that many things we did, it works except this one, and it's just a statement. It's amazing you have a model, and many things just come out to work without you adjust parameters except one, so I can express my worries.
You have actually two parts to yourself. One is that you develop a model, you got a model for non-linear
distribution. Yes. The second part
you
is.
You've checked that about how well it affects simulation.
Yeah.
And the second part is then the sort of something about cooling.
So to get R of M. And this allows me to go to the luminosity function.
The second part isn't independent. So if you say something works with previous models and don't work, and work with this model works with previous models. So in fact, the physics is still the same as the previous model. So some of the previous models didn't even use the fact check, they actually used the simulation correctly.
Yes, and of course. Yes, and of course, if you use the simulation with the same physics, you get the same problems.
And also, you get the same answer. You know? So the fact
check can be done. The only difference is I'm taking this function h of x from simulation, then I am independent and I can do my calculation without.
But so what is the difference?
Just having this function h of x, realizing that to define an object needs a relation R of m, you think about cooling, you calculate this relation R of m, you can directly see. No, I'm just saying that I understand what I do. Because I see, if you have the simulation, realizing that you just need one rule R of m to define an object, for me it's more obvious looking at my function h of x and seeing that I need this.
Shannon's point is it leads to a different result, so something doesn't work here.
I'm sure if you do this, what I do with the simulation instead of using my scaling law, you will find the same result.
So, but I'm talking about the simulation. You take the simulation,
but
identify the object each time.
Sure.
Of
course, I totally agree with you. The only remark I can say is that realizing that I need this and this is the key is easier having the analytical formula than having the simulation. And once you have realized this, do this in the simulation, gives you obviously the same. Yeah. That gives you obviously the same result. But sometimes you see things more easily if you have an analytical formula.
Then.
Not for the galaxies, I see. I think you would not be able to do the galaxies using fresh checker. Yes. Let's say I use fresh checker as honestly as I could to make the same calculation using fresh checker. And if I find again the galaxy, it depends with what you are happy and what you are unhappy. Let me put it this way, at which degree of accuracy. I use the press sector in a regime, as we say, the press sector should not be used because it's not 200. But if I use it just because it gives me a function h of x and so on, this is what press sector gives me.
I use the press sector only in the regime of 200, but you specify the history.
Yes, but the history, here it's not, these objects are not defined by 200, there's stable objects, or, yeah. Or you can say it was 200 at z equals 2, yes.
the defined at redshift 200 when the galaxy is formed, not where it is today.
Yes, but this projector scales as my function scales. So if I use it at z equals 2, where it's 200, it's a,
yeah.
This is your projector.
It's the same physics, it's the same calculation.
Yeah.
So you should get some
results. Yeah, if I make this calculation at z equals 2, look at the number of objects. How do you do it with projector?
You actually follow the dynamics and construct the history with time. The redshift 2, 1.9, 1.8, 1.7.
But then it's no longer projector because at 2 it's density 200.
It's a merge tree constructed from the projector.
But you follow it by simulations.
Well, then apparently.
Yeah.
You can also do the same thing directly on the simulation, not use the projector at all. But all I'm saying is if you implement it directly on the simulation,
I think I did honestly the press structure. This is what you would do using press. This is what you would get using press structure according to the rules. At delta equals 200, at z equals 2. You define the objects. Yeah, of course, yes, but. I have objects which are quiet, which no longer merge after z equals 2.
Of course, some do and some don't. So you get to that
Or let's say, you take two galaxies at z equals 2, and claiming they are quiet. They, of course, merge to build a group, but since I only count galaxies, I don't see, well, I decided not to look at this. And sometimes galaxies merge as well, and I'm just saying that here you have a lot of mergers. In my approximation here, you don't have mergers at all, you have no merger at all. And,
the formula is supposed to describe simulations, but then simulate hybrid models, which are...
Let's say, if my assumption that h of x...
Exactly the same result than what you were saying.
Yeah. If my assumption that my function h of x is only, it's the only thing you need to describe simulations, everything else I do, if you do the same, you should get the same result. It's the same difficulty.
Well, if the R of n or R of t is indeed exactly the same recipe for, I can't...
Yeah, okay, yes, if you use the same recipe with simulation.
But I suppose if you look at a real simulation, the number of evolutionary pathways is much more complicated. There are many evolutionary pathways to get to the same day.
Yes. That's because you think in terms of press sector.
I don't care about press sector.
Yeah, but you can think this way. But you can also think that taking at a given time, the density field recognize the objects and select them. And of course, if you want to attach a star formation right to the galaxy, you have to define its history. And if the object is quiet, yeah, if the object is quiet and doesn't merge, it's easy. If the objects merge, we have to decide, let's say, what was the cloud, the initial cloud that from which the object. In this part here, which are the small objects which are merging, we have to attach a star formation history. We have to decide from where these objects come from and what...
You can look at all the ensemble of all possible histories.
And you can get the dispersion. And since I'm doing a calculation and analytically it's difficult, I can only calculate the mean. I'm not able to calculate the dispersion. That's the only difference. I'm able to calculate the mean object, the mean of the objects that... entered, let's say, were the mergers. So I'm constructing a merging history in some sense for the mean object, but I'm not able to calculate the dispersion. This is so. In this sense, it's something you can do. Yeah, of course. I'm just saying that, understanding from where these features come from. For me, it was easier having my scaling function h rather than having a simulation.
Well, what if the actually the simulation at all,
I'm sure would you get the, would you put the same cooling physics in? Would you, I'm sure you, would you put the same physics in? In this part, there is no merging history because these objects are isolated in IUs. In this part, it continues, there is a merging history, and we have to make an assumption on what the merging history is. But this is not the part which is under discussion. It's this part, I'm saying.
The isolated, at some point, has some merging. They
form something. Yes, at Drupal 2, you had a lot of merging, and then it stops, and this corresponds to a metallicity of minus 0.7, which is the Hallow metallicity, and then I'm saying the object, in my approximation, is totally isolated, and of course might be some merging, but in my approximation there is none, and I'm still saying this is where the disk forms, and I have a hint, a prediction for the metallicity where this thing happens, and so...
What scale do you actually compare your RMM, well, your HMX to...
I can tell you in terms of density contrast, not in terms of ready, because I just happen to know the numbers.
Okay.
We looked at density contrast going from minus 0.5, so delta equals, so 1 plus delta equals 0.5, and delta equals minus 0.5, so half over dense, to a delta equals 5,000. And we compared this scaling functions. And if someone is interested, we have made many, many comparisons, because I told you you should use the same function h of x for the counter cells and the objects. Depending on how exactly you define the objects, there are statistical biases, and h of x is not exactly the one I told you, and I have a whole, I know all that, but I skipped all this. So if someone is interested, well, we can talk in private about it. I should go very shortly about this. Yeah, okay. So, well, just, well, I just show you one picture, maybe, which is, so, let's say, one thing, we did the clusters, but the clusters is delta equals 200, there's nothing special about clusters. I think our model just works for clusters, and but here it's really pressure works also, and we just, it's the last thing we did after having done the galaxies, the line and alphas, just for completeness, but it's not the most important. This is something, and this is the number of line and alpha clouds according to the column density, and it's a curve that doesn't work, that I'm very proud of it. This is a curve with no parameter whatsoever, just taking whatever we had done for galaxies, whatever we had done for h of x, just applying it to line and alpha clouds, and that's where it comes in. That's what it comes in. In the published paper, we have a curve that goes through these points, because you have to put some parameters in. These objects are able to cool a little bit, and so the variance settle down, become more dense. There's a little history, so if you want to reproduce this, you have to add new parameters, but we are able to reproduce the Lyman alpha clouds, the distribution as well as the evolution of the shift with no additional parameter. The only new thing that enters is the UV flux, which is, let's say, badly measured, but it's measured. So within the measure, we have a little freedom and that we can adjust, but you have a prediction. So, and of course, well, the clusters work also, and our formula work a little better than the press sector, but well, that's one. So.